From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Edward E. Jacks, 51 years old, Navy Lieutenant Commander, January 29, 2005.
Carlos Arredondo lost his son Alex in Iraq. He's joined hundreds in Times Square reading the names of the dead in the lead-up to the fourth anniversary of the U.S. invasion. But first, President Bush is finishing up his Latin American tour. We'll speak with Charlie Kernaghan about Guatemala and so-called free trade. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Protests continue to follow President Bush as he finishes out his Latin American tour in Guatemala Monday. President Bush heard more criticism on U.S. treatment of undocumented immigrants. For the first time, the president said he'd like to see Congress pass new immigration laws by August. But he defended several controversial measures, including the construction of the border wall and carrying out mass deportations.
It's against the law for somebody to hire somebody's in our country illegally. And therefore, the deportations took place as a result of law enforcement enforcing the law. This is why they can say, oh, maybe there's Guatemalans here, let's go get them. That's what happened. Just so you know, you've got to understand that when we enforce the law, we do so in a fair and rational way.
As Bush spoke, hundreds of protesters marched on Guatemala's National Palace. More than 5,000 police officers were deployed. Demonstrators also scuffled with police at the ancient Mayan capital of Imchi. This is Professor Cesar Paul.
We are protesting because we are against the visit of Bush. The U.S. financed the civil war in the 1980s when there were many massacres.
Despite the protests, President Bush was able to visit the Chimchi ruins. The Associated Press reports Mayan priests decided to purify the sacred archaeological grounds to get rid of, quote, bad spirits following Bush's visit. The Bush administration's roots in supporting military repression in Latin America during the 1980s has played a prominent role in the reaction to Bush's visit. In Nicaragua, President Daniel Ortega called on the U.S. to respect the 1986 judgment of the World Court that said the Reagan administration should pay Nicaragua $17 billion for committing unlawful aggression.
The court said that the United States should cease these aggressions against Nicaragua and should compensate Nicaragua with $17 billion. And if President Bush recognizes this debt and withdraw its troops from Iraq, then we would be dealing with a state that could accept that they cannot be aggressors.
The U.S. mined Nicaragua's harbors. President Bush is in Mexico today for the last stop of his Latin America tour. New information has revealed the Bush administration's role in the firing of eight U.S. attorneys is greater than previously thought. The White House has admitted administration officials worked with the Justice Department to draw up a list of U.S. attorneys who would lose their jobs. At one point 2 years ago, administration officials even floated the idea of firing all 93 U.S. attorneys at once. The White House also admitted President Bush spoke with Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez about Republican concerns the prosecutors were not pursuing voter fraud cases. Seven of the prosecutors were asked to step down just weeks later. On Monday, Gonzalez Chief of Staff D. Kyle Sampson resigned after acknowledging he did not properly inform the Justice Department of his consultations with the White House. Sampson's email records show extensive discussion with top deputy Karl Rove and then White House counsel Harriet Myers. The Bush administration had previously claimed it only approved of a list of fired U.S. attorneys after it was drafted by the Justice Department. In military news, Army Surgeon General Kevin Kiley has resigned under pressure from senior Army leaders. Kiley's the third top military official to lose his job in the controversy over the neglect of wounded soldiers at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Kiley was the Walter Reed commander 3 years ago and is said to have ignored complaints of poor conditions. The chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General is stoking controversy today for calling homosexuality immoral and defending the military ban on openly gay service members. In an interview with the Chicago Tribune, General Peter Pace said, quote, "My upbringing is such that I believe there are certain things, certain types of conduct that are immoral. I believe that homosexual acts between individuals are immoral and that we should not condone immoral acts," he said. In other military news, new figures tracking criminal prosecutions of U.S. soldiers show a growing trend of alcohol and drug-related crimes. The New York Times reports alcohol and drug-related charges represent more than a third of all criminal prosecutions of soldiers serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. 240 cases resulted in convictions. 73 of those cases involved murder, rape, or armed robbery. 12 convictions for sex crimes were linked to drug and alcohol use. On Capitol Hill, Democratic leaders have announced they're now abandoning an effort to put limits on President Bush's authority to take military action against Iran. Democrats had included a provision in the new military spending bill that would have required congressional approval for any military confrontation with Iran. But the requirement was dropped after several Democrats argued it would take away the use of force as a bargaining tool over Iran's nuclear program. The wife of the convicted war resistor Agustin Aguayo is vowing to continue to fight for her husband's release from a military prison. Aguayo was sentenced last week to an 8-month term. Helga Aguayo spoke at a news conference Monday in Germany where her husband is detained.
What I do want now is my husband be released, which will happen 40, 45 days. And we take this we pursue it legally, and that he is found to be a conscientious objector. One, that his conviction of desertion is overturned. Two, and that he's given an honorable discharge. That's all I hope for.
Agustin Aguayo is an Army medic. He was deployed to Iraq where he refused to use a gun for a year. He had applied for conscientious objector status and was denied. It was when he was deployed again that he went AWOL, though ultimately turned himself in Fort Irwin in California, was returned to Germany, where he was court-martialed last week. In the occupied territories, a BBC reporter has been kidnapped in Gaza. Alan Johnston is the BBC's correspondent there. Hamas spokesperson Fawzi Barhoum called for his release.
Our call for this killer and kidnapper and destructive group to let this foreign journalist Alan Johnston free immediately with no condition and not to affect him with any type of violence.
In Zimbabwe, a jailed and badly beaten opposition leader has appeared in court for the first time since his arrest 2 days ago. Morgan Tsvangirai has, and dozens of his supporters, were detained Sunday as riot police stopped a planned mass protest. Witnesses say police beat Tsvangirai so severely he lost consciousness. He's head of the Movement for Democratic Change. This is the party's deputy president, Thokozani Kupe.
I would like to warn Robert Gabriel Mugabe and ZANU-PF that no amount of police brutality can either stop or delay the people's march to freedom. Zimbabweans will never give up their right to economic and political freedom.
The Syrian government has renewed calls for direct negotiations with the United States. The move came as Assistant Secretary of State Ellen Saubry was in Damascus Monday for talks on Iraqi refugees. It was the highest-level visit by a U.S. diplomat in nearly 2 years. The Bush administration has so far rejected further talks with Syria beyond the situation in Iraq. Back in the United States, the Bush administration is urging an appeals court to dismiss a lawsuit accusing the telecom giant AT&T of illegally helping the National Security Agency spy on the internet use of U.S. citizens. In court papers released Monday, the Justice Department says the suit's subject matter, including AT&T's ties to government surveillance, is a state secret. The filing was released by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which brought the suit. And finally, in Massachusetts, the head of the state social services is calling for the release of 21 workers seized in last week's massive immigration raid. Commissioner Harry Spence says the workers have no one else to care for their children. More than 300 people were detained, most of them women. Many have already been flown to a detention center in Texas where they await possible deportation. Senator Edward Kennedy is calling on the Department of Homeland Security to return the jailed workers to Massachusetts for a supervised release. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. For the past week on his trip through Latin America, President Bush has been praising U.S. efforts to end poverty in the hemisphere and promoting the benefits of so-called free trade agreements with Washington.
The millions across our hemisphere who every day suffer the degradations of poverty and hunger have a right to be impatient. And I'm going to make them this pledge. The goal of this great country, the goal of a country full of generous people, is an America where the dignity of every person is respected, where all find room at the table, and where opportunity reaches into every village and every home.
On Monday, President Bush traveled to Guatemala and said free trade can spread opportunity, provide jobs, and help lift people out of poverty. But there's a darker side about the U.S.-Guatemalan trade relations. Less than 10 miles from where Bush spoke, there's a food processing plant where children as young as 13 years old are working under deplorable conditions. According to the New York-based National Labor Committee, the children working at a factory owned by Legomex harvest and process vegetables and fruits exported to the United States. The National Labor Committee has just published a report on the conditions at the factory. It's called Harvest of Shame. Charlie Kernaghan joins us now. He's veteran anti-sweatshop activist, executive director of the National Labor Committee. Welcome, Charlie, to Democracy Now.
Good to be here.
So what did you find in Guatemala?
Well, like you said, as President Bush was there speaking about the benefits of CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, there are children working in these processing factories. These are agro-industrial plants. They process fruits and vegetables for export to the U.S. This Legomex factory exported more than 4 million pounds of frozen broccoli and melons and pineapples to the U.S. last year, much of it going to U.S. school children, we think, because it was coming through a company called Cisco. Well, inside the factory, they're all kids. The vast majority were 13 years of age to 17, 16, 17 years of age. It looks like a high school, but it's not a high school. These kids are going in from 7 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock at night, 14 hours a day, 6 days a week. Sometimes they have to come in earlier at 6 o'clock or 6:30 in the morning. They do an extraordinary amount of work, these young kids. 13-year-old kids, we watch them cutting up broccoli. You know, you buy those frozen broccoli florets in the stores. Every head of broccoli, they grab these heads of broccoli, and with a knife, they make 37 cuts, and then with their hands, they break the broccoli apart into 97 pieces. So there's 97 operations. They do one broccoli every 64 seconds. So they're making a cut every 7/10 of a second, and this is all day long, 7/10 of a second. Flying through they're cutting themselves with their knives. They're on their feet all day. They say their feet swell up. Their backs hurt. They're exhausted. They make the same movements over and over again. Their wrists swell up. But they told us something was extraordinary. They were doing like 692 pounds of fruit and vegetables a day. These are 13, 14, 15-year-old kids. But they said to us the worst was the melon. And we said, like, why? They said, well, you're working in water because they're constantly washing the floor. So here you have 13, 14, 15-year-old kids standing in sneakers in an inch of water for 12 hours. And they say that their feet begin to crack the skin and bleeds. And they begin to bleed. And they just kept going on. They said, you know, the factory is quite cold. This area of Guatemala is in the highland. It's quite cold. And plus, they're freezing these vegetables. So there's a lot. Their workers are surrounding in an area called preparation, surrounded by all of these freezers. And it's freezing cold in there. And they won't let the kids wear sweaters because the sweaters may get lint onto the fruit or onto the vegetables. So you have kids working in cold temperatures in T-shirts, but all the supervisors are walking around in sweatshirts and jackets. And they also say to the kids, it'll make you lazy if you wear the sweater. So if you wear that sweater, we're taking away from you. We're going to throw it away. So you have kids, you know, working 12 hours a day in the cold, often standing in an inch of water. Their feet are bleeding. Their hands are cut. And they're cheated of their wages. And the company actually tells the kids that this company was not, too reticent to discuss with the children why they wanted them. They said, look, you have no responsibilities. You don't have families. You're not a parent. You don't have to worry about kids, a house. You're just here to work. And they were constantly screaming at them to go faster, go faster. Most of the workers were earning about half of the legal minimum wage. They didn't have Social Security, which is a mandatory in Guatemala. They weren't paid for holidays. This place was a bad place. And this was right next to where George Bush was giving us talk about the benefits of free trade.
Explain who gets the fruit and the cut vegetables here in the United States. How does the system work?
Well, this was interesting because it's very difficult to track, but we were able to track the frozen broccoli and other goods into the United States to a company called Superior in California, Watsonville, California. From Superior, it would go to giant companies like Sysco, which is the largest food processing and distributor company in the United States. It also went to U.S. Foods, which Food Services, which is the second largest food service company in the United States. Much of this stuff went to schools, which means that children in Guatemala were not only harvesting the broccoli, children in Guatemala were processing the broccoli. And that broccoli was coming to the United States, and it was being eaten by children in the United States in schools. It also went to the U.S. military, also went to federally funded hospitals. So on the one hand, while we talk about worker rights protections and CAFTA, which, of course, is zero, when we talk about them, that's one thing. But just imagine the message it delivers to a factory like Legomex when the U.S. military buys products indirectly, but the U.S. military is buying products made in that factory. So the real message is do whatever you want. We don't care.
Since you reported that the vast majority of the exports at the Legomex factory in Guatemala are sold to Superior Foods based in Watsonville, California, we invited a representative of Superior Foods to join us on the program, but the company declined. They did, however, issue a written statement. Marco Cruz of Superior Foods said, quote, "We're surprised and concerned about the labor violations alleged in the NLC report, and will immediately investigate these serious allegations in that particular facility. We outspokenly do not support producers who cannot clearly demonstrate that they abide by local labor laws, and we will discontinue working with this processor if abuses are evident and not entirely and satisfactorily resolved." Your response?
Well, the kids told us that North Americans came into the factory all the time, maybe even once a month. They didn't talk to the kids, but they're there. They knew what was going on. So they're in and out of the factory every month. They could see. I mean, some of the kids are so small, it's like shocking. So it would be impossible not to know. And also, one other aspect of this factory is that they have a swing shift for the kids, where they work a day shift 1 week from 7 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night. This is in what's called the processing department, where they actually freeze the vegetables and fruit. The following week, they swing to an all-night night shift from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 7 o'clock in the morning, 14 hours. So you have a 15-year-old girl we interviewed. All night, you're standing in this factory, 14 hours, right through the night. And they're sick. They're collapsing because you can't adjust your sleeping habits and your eating habits from week to week. And it's freezing. And she tells us you're in there, you're coughing, you're spitting up blood. And they go to ask the supervisor that they feel faint, dizzy. Can they sit down? And the supervisor screams at them, if you walk away from your place once more, we're going to mark you absent for the day.
I was interested that Superior Foods said that they must comply with local labor law. What is the local labor law in Guatemala?
It's extremely contradictory. It defines a child as someone who's under 14 years age. So legally in Guatemala, you could work from 14 up. But then they have loopholes so that 10 or 11-year-olds can work if it's an apprenticeship and if their parents agree and if it's light work. I mean, it's not very good labor law. It says in one place the work week is 45 hours. In the next sentence, it says it's 48 hours. I mean, it's all over the map. And it's not enforced. There is absolutely 100% zero enforcement of these labor laws. And the thing about CAFTA, we've had worker rights language in agreements with Central America and the Caribbean since 1983, when the first Caribbean Basin Initiative Expansion Act came on board. So we had internationally recognized worker rights standards in our trade benefit programs with Central America since 1983. It's 24 years later. We have the same worker rights language in the CAFTA, and nothing changes. The children are working. There's no unions. In the apparel industry in Guatemala, there's 900,600 workers. There's 100 workers organized in a union, which means that the unionization rate amongst the apparel workers is 0.1%. These workers in this Legomex factory never even heard of a union. We said, do you have a union? They'd look at us. We said, do you know what a union is? They'd say, well, not really. What is it? I mean, it's out of control.
Explain CAFTA. Explain its effect and the role of the Democrats and the Republicans.
Well, you know, the CAFTA agreement just squeaked through with two votes in the House. It was not very popular. It's certainly not popular in Central America. People see what's going on. So this is an agreement.
The Central American Free Trade Agreement.
The Central America Free Trade Agreement. This is an agreement which, you know, the administration was just desperate to keep some sort of momentum with these free trade agreements, and they figured they could, you know, do this with Central America. We have six free trade agreements now in the United States with countries like Jordan, which was turned into slavery and human trafficking. But essentially, you know, it's opening up Central America to U.S. multinational corporations. It's got all the investment rights down. In fact, the U.S. Trade Representative went to bat for pharmaceutical companies to make sure that those countries in Central America couldn't make generic drugs. So the U.S. Trade Representative, like, fought like mad to make sure we defended the pharmaceutical companies in the United States, the multinationals. But when it came to worker rights, you'd have the same language, which was meaningless. And there's no attempt to enforce the labor laws. I mean, it's a bad agreement. And it's not good for the people of Guatemala. It's not good for the people of the United States. And it really just squeaked through by two votes. And if they hadn't been buying Congress people off, it never would have passed.
Charlie Kernaghan, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Charlie Kernaghan is director of the National Labor Committee. We'll link to their report, Harvest of Shame, at our website, democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Teacher, teacher, did you not behave? Did you teach the children war is not okay? Why are you packing up your stuff? Did they ship you out to shut you up? What's happening here? Soldier, soldier, did you lose a limb? Based on a rich man's will, where are all your benefits? Did they fund the tax cuts for the rich? What's happening here? Don't you know you gotta rise up, seek the truth, shout out.
Jamie Green, what's happening here? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Next week marks the fourth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. During those 4 years, nearly 3,200 American soldiers have died. Many thousands more have been wounded. As many as 650,000 Iraqis have been killed, with the number of wounded unknown. As this fourth anniversary approaches, a coalition of anti-war groups has created the Endless War Memorial in Times Square here in New York. Hundreds of people have come together for a six-day reading of thousands of names of the war dead in Iraq, including Americans, so-called coalition soldiers, Iraqis, and journalists.
Christopher Simney, 27 years old, Marine Corporal, January 21st, 2005.
Abdul Hussein Ghazal, correspondent of the U.S.-funded television station Ahura, 2/9/2005.
Sheikh Jassim Ashil, also known as Abu Farad, an adult political party member, killed in Baghdad, January 27, 2004.
Edward E. Jacks, 51 years old, Navy Lieutenant Commander, January 29, 2005.
Yasser Abdul, also known as Abu Jamal, an adult political party member, killed in the district of Al-Jadida Mashtal, Baghdad, January 22, 2005. 2004.
Kate Edward Taylor, 47 years old, Navy Lieutenant Commander, January 29, 2005.
That was Carlos Sarlando. His son, Alex, was killed in Najaf, August 25, 2004. Carlos has traveled across the country with an empty coffin and a picture of his son's open casket and funeral. He was in Times Square yesterday afternoon. He joins us in the studio right now. We welcome you to Democracy Now.
Good morning.
Carlos, why did you come to Times Square?
We getting ready for the march in Washington, and we got prepared in Times Square to read all these fallen heroes, including my son's name, Iraqi citizens, people from the NATO forces, people who died from the media. So we've been up there trying to share these feelings this morning that we have public.
Talk about your son, Alex, how you learned that he died on August 25th, 2004. It was your 44th birthday that day?
That's correct. That day was my 44th birthday. And when I first saw the Marines pull over in front of my house, I thought it was a surprise for my birthday. And instead was...
That Alex was coming home?
Yes. Instead, what happened is they was coming to inform the death of my son. And that day, my whole world turned upside down. And by then I learned 974 servicemen has been dying already, and it's been a very difficult times at the moment, dealing with the whole situation, seeing how the administration has been conducting the war in Iraq, and feeling for the pain, not only for the American families, but also what the families in Iraq was going through. And when 974 knocked on my door that day, the worst nightmare I ever have. I just keep asking the group of young Marines who show up at my house to leave my house, because I was hoping that nightmare go away, and perhaps they was in the wrong house, they got the wrong name. Unfortunately, this denial many Ghost Star families we going through when they come to inform us, and the way the things escalate by the people who were there don't leaving when I was asking to leave for more than half hour, three different times. And was a point where I come out with a hammer and gasoline and a gas propane torch.
A gas propane torch.
And I pretty much, I destroyed the U.S. government van who was there, knowing that my son one time took that van away and never returned.
Now, the Marines were outside of the van, but you went to the van and you started to hammer away and to pour gasoline on it.
The Marine was parked in front of my house. They stand right there the whole time. They never bother to bring inside the house or bring any support or chaplain for that matter. And I keep asking for three different times to leave my house, and I just took it the way I took it.
Your mother was there. She had just baked a birthday cake for you.
My mother was there, and she was already preparing the celebration for my birthday. And she's the only one pretty much who was trying to rescue me, to do something about it, because I saw the Marines pretty much making phone calls after I was acting. And that's the way pretty much I deal with the situation at the moment. This is one of the many mistakes this war has been conducted in many situations all along.
And so what happened after you poured the gas in the van?
I went inside the U.S. government van, and then I started destroying everything inside and screaming and yelling for my son, and pretty much knowing that this really was happening. And then I started pouring gasoline all over the van, and then it was very hard to breathe. And then I opened the gas can, the propane gas, and...
Your mother had come then?
My mother was in the side door of the van, and she was at the moment, screaming and yelling for help. Nobody was around there to help her. And she tried to reach my hand to pull me out. That's when I pretty much pressed the button for the flames to come out, and the explosion occurred, threw me out of the van on fire, landing in the ground, and then wake up in the hospital later on with 26% of my body burned, second and third degree.
Your wife had pulled up at that point, had driven
home? My wife pulled up at that point, a couple minutes right after the explosion, and pretty much she ran to help me and to see if it was okay, and came to my aid.
Where was your other son, Brian, 16?
At the time, Brian was in Bangor, Maine, where his mother lived, my ex-wife. One then pulled over in Bangor, Maine at the moment, and one then pulled over in Hollywood, Florida at the same time. So it was two different notification teams at the moment.
So one was informing your wife and your son, and one van had come to inform you.
And the one in Bangor, Maine, they brought a chaplain, they brought three Marines, and they pretty much walked into to the living room to talk to my ex-wife. And my case was totally different. My case was only three Marines. They never brought a chaplain. They never brought me inside the living room. I didn't have any support. I just have anger for what I already lived through what I learned through the media about this war, how it was being conducted in Iraq.
And so after being burned on about a quarter of your body, what did you do? Were you able to make it to your son's funeral?
I was transported from Florida all the way to Massachusetts for my son's burial, thank God. We have an open casket, thank God for that too, thank God, because not too many families lucky as we are, you know. And even that is for granted because not everybody has lucky to have an open casket, and the way the soldiers died today. I was transported in a bed. Thank God that I was there, which was very important for me to be there. And as soon as I get off from the hospital, I was already talking to the media, sharing my grief and letting know what really happened here.
And so soon after you began this odyssey, rolling a coffin across the country, an empty coffin, why are you doing that?
Well, this is my pain, this is my loss. My son, honor to protect us. I'm protecting my son, honor. As you know, what happened in Walter Reef recently, in Building 18, myself and many people are not too happy about the way they treating the soldiers who come back from the battlefield right now. But the way I start doing that is for my own personal healing process, making this very public, since the government don't want we to see caskets during the funerals. And it's a way for me to share this grieving with the public, because many people live in their own bubbles, and then they don't care really about what's going on outside their own bubbles. And I want them to feel what they see, what did really happen every day, not only in this country, but this happened all over the country. We have NATO forces from El Salvador, Spain, England, Australia, and it's a high number of casualties from these countries also.
We're talking to Carlos Arredondo, who lost his son. He was 20 years old and 20 days, August 25th, 2004, in Najaf. He was a Marine Lance Corporal, Alexander S. Arredondo. You have since become an American citizen. You were born in Costa Rica.
That's right, that's correct. On December 12th, I received my citizenship that day. Also that day, when I wake up, I learn about three other U.S. servicemen who died. And this is nonstop, every day happen. I was very grateful that I received my citizenship, because with the way I've been doing my mourning, very public, so I was very worried about the corpus law, the past against any people who do any act against the government, or perhaps if be picked up for any other reason. And thank God I had the opportunity now. Even then, I was pretty much practicing the First Amendment of the Constitution, and I'm still now holding my passport up and saying, sharing these thoughts with many, many people around the country.
Others got their citizenship that day with you who had fought in Iraq?
Oh, yeah, we have there almost 1,000 people receiving the citizenship. And also that day we have there three U.S. soldiers who already been in Iraq fighting, and they was there because they served the country, and that's the way they was saying, that's the way for them to get the citizenship.
Carlos, you changed your name on that day?
Yes, I also changed my name. I changed my name after my sons. My name now is Alexander Brian Arredondo. I had the opportunity, and I think to honor my sons is a grateful opportunity. And my
so Alexander duty. For your older son who died, and Brian for your younger son who's
Correct.
Now 19.
Yes.
So I've been looking through this notebook that you have of the letters your younger son, Brian, has been receiving from the Army National Guard as they try to recruit him. And there's some remarkable ones. This latest one that you showed me in Times Square last night says, "This is not a credit card. This is money in the bank." And this is a fake credit card that is on this piece of paper that has his name, Brian Lewis Arredondo. And it says, "This card could entitle you to over $60,000 in cash and other benefits as a qualified member of the National Guard. As a member of the National Guard, you may also qualify for college first enlistment option, up to $20,000 enlistment bonus, up to $10,368 for books and fees, as much as $12,600 to cover additional college costs, and $4,500 in tuition assistance benefits."
Yeah, that's just, I'm outraged about that. You know, I already lost my older son, and they're still trying to seduce my other son, Brian, with all these money and these promises. And as you see this happen all over the country right now, in the malls, in the hallways of the high schools, and that's a way how they seduce our sons and daughters. And we need to do something about that because they're getting out of hand. Now not even the immigrants are safe because they're offering them the citizenship to serve the country.
I'm looking at another letter. That one was signed by Colonel Michael Jones, Chief Strength Maintenance Division, National Guard Bureau, Arlington, Virginia. This is Richard Guzzetta, Colonel, National Guard Bureau. And in this letter, this recruiting letter, it says, "You could be eligible for an enlistment bonus of up to $20,000 for joining the Army National Guard. What can you do with $20,000? A new car? Pay off credit cards? Help your family? It's up to you. It'll be your money, money you earn by making a commitment to serve your country. Remember, the decisions you're making right now will have a huge impact on how the rest of your life turns out."
Well, sons and daughters have a really hard time just being up there trying to deal with all these corporations who are selling all this stuff to them. And top of that, the recruiters come to the high school and they seduce our sons with all these promises. And we have all these corporations behind the administration Bush who really need to sell their own weapons. They need to sell whatever they need to sell. And they pretty much get all these programs together somehow to our community. And I think it's enough is enough. Kifaya, basta ya, suficiente.
I was watching the police interact with you. You not only brought the coffin to Times Square, right in front of the Army recruiting station, where they have a very big, illuminated Army video that goes around the clock. And the police on horseback were there. There were police standing in the street. But they were very solicitous of you. You also had a car nearby that is covered with pictures of your son, of Alex, a letter he wrote that's blown up that you have for people to read. You call it Camp Alex. You've got his army boots there. How have the police treated you? What's their response to you?
Well, the police right here in Times Square, New York, they know better than any other police station in the United States Forces. They've really been still mourning 9/11, and they are very helpful. They are good there for. I can say a lot of good things about how good they've been treating us and support us. And thank to the Department of Police on New York for helping us.
And why do you think they have treated you in this way?
Well, because like I say, you know, some of them already been in the National Guard. They already have a high number of casualties themselves from New York. And like I said, they know better. They know better. They feel it. They don't need to see a war. You look at the faces and they pretty much telling me what the position are on the war.
As you drag this coffin, rolling it across the street, you stop people, just passersby. People have nothing to do with you, dead in their tracks when they see this coffin. I met you in Labor Day weekend, Provincetown, Cape Cod. It was the big holiday weekend. You're coming down Main Street with a pickup truck with this coffin in the back, and people stop. Where else have you gone around the country, and where are you headed now?
We've been from the East Coast all the way to the San Diego border, to all the way to Olympia, Seattle, Washington State, to Texas, all the way to Idaho, and across country.
And today you're headed?
And the next stop will be Washington, D.C. for the march
tomorrow?
This Saturday. First, I went to Philadelphia, and then I will be going to Washington, D.C. for the march and welcome everyone. And also, it's going to be a march here in New York City on Saturday, the 18th. Everybody, welcome. Please participate. It's our duty and responsibility. And also, after that, I'm going to be going for a whole month with a hip-hop tour across country, which we're going to be going to many different cities.
And on Saturday, you'll be with the March on the Pentagon.
We're going big with the organization ANSWER and participate with many other organizations who we're going to be pretty much put in practice the First Amendment of the Constitution and also trying to let it know that we're here and we're going nowhere.
Have you talked to members of Congress?
Yes, I've been meeting with members on Congress at different times and letting know that we need to do a change and we are here to help them, just letting know what's our position on this, because they know what is our position on this, but we have to remind them that we are here and we're here to work with them.
Carlos Arredondo, I want to thank you for being with us, a Gold Star father. He lost his son, Marine Lance Corporal Alexander S. Arredondo, August 25th, 2004, it was Carlos's 44th birthday. Carlos now heads to Washington to march on the Pentagon on Saturday. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
لا نمر مرة بدربكم حالفين لا نعود يوم على حبكم غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت غلطة مرت وانتهت شمعة العشرة انطفت والذنب هو ذنبكم والذنب هو ذنبكم تايبين وللمحبة ما يرجعنا الحنين ما يرجعنا الحنين غلطة ودفعنا ثمنها أجمل أيام السنين.
عمر توفيق here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the 2007 Left Forum came to a close Sunday in New York City. Each spring, the forum convenes the largest gathering here in the country of the international left. With close to 100 panels, three major cultural events, the Left Forum brings together organizers and intellectuals from across the globe. One of those who spoke was professor, culture critic, social justice advocate Cornel West. He's been described as one of America's most vital and eloquent public intellectuals, a professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University. Professor West is a critic of culture, now analyst of postmodern art and philosophy, has written and co-authored many books on philosophy, race, and sociology. His most recent book is Democracy Matters, Winning the Fight Against Imperialism. He addressed a panel at the Left Forum. Cornel West began by talking about the status of the political left in 2007.
What does it really mean to be a leftist in the early part of the 21st century? What are we really talking about? And I can just be very candid with you. It means to have a certain kind of temperament, to make certain kinds of political and ethical choices and to exercise certain analytical focuses and targeting on the catastrophic and the monstrous, the scandalous, the traumatic that are often hidden and concealed in the deodorized and manicured discourses of the mainstream. That's what it means to be a leftist. So let's just be clear about it. So that if you were concerned about structural violence, if you're concerned about exploitation at the workplace, if you're concerned about institutionalized contempt against gay brothers and lesbian sisters, if you're concerned about organized hatred against peoples of color, if you're concerned about the subordination of women, that's not cheap PC chit-chat. That is a calling that you're willing to fight against and try to understand the sources of that social misery at the structural and institutional level and at the existential and the personal level. That's what it means, in part, to be a leftist. That's why we choose to be certain kinds of human beings. That's why it's a calling, not a career. It's a vocation, not a profession. That's why you see these veterans still here year after year after year, because they are convinced they don't want to live in a world and they don't want to be human in such a way that they don't exercise their intellectual and political and social and cultural resources in some way to leave the world just a little better than it was when they entered. That's in part what it means to be a leftist. Now, what does that mean for me? It means for me in the United States, and I go back now the 400 years of Jamestown. You all know this is the 400th anniversary of the first enduring English settlement in the New World. There was Roanoke before, but it didn't last. Jamestown lasts. And what do you have at Jamestown? The Virginia Club of London, an extension of the British Empire, makes its way over, the three boats whose names we need not go into at the moment. And what do? They interact with another empire, the Towhatan Empire, that's already in place of indigenous peoples. You actually get the clash of empire. This is the age of empire. But what are they here for? Looking for gold and silver and secondarily to civilize the natives. So already you get America as a corporation before it's a country. Corporate greed is already sitting at the center in terms of what is pushing it. And corporate greed, as Marx understood it, capital as a social relation, an asymmetric relation of power with bosses and workers, with those at the top who will be able to live lives of luxury and those whose labor will be both indispensable, necessary, but also exploited in order to produce that wealth. Then there's religion, to civilize the indigenous peoples. Now, you can't talk about the U.S. experience, and I think in many ways this is true for the New World experience, without talking about the dominant role of religion as an ideology. And we also know one of the reasons why vast numbers of our fellow citizens today in the United States, one of the reasons why they're not leftists is precisely because they have not been awakened from their sleepwalk and they have not been convinced that they ought to choose to live a life the way we have chosen, in part because we've been cast with the mark of the anti-religious or the naively secular or what have you. And that's 98% of fellow citizens. So no matter what kind of political organization Brother Stanley's talking about, he's going to get gumption about it. He's got to dip into the popular culture of the everyday people. And 98% of them talking about God. That's 97.5 fellow Americans believe in God. 75% believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God. 62% believe they speak on intimate terms with God at least twice a day. That's who we're dealing with in terms of our fellow citizens. You can't talk about an organization that's sustained over time unless you're talking in Gramsci in terms of how do you tease out leftist sentiment, vision, analysis in light of the legacy of these dominant ideologies, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, and so forth and so on. But then what else happens? 1619. You got white slaves and you've got black slaves. You have the first representative assembly that takes place as modeled on the corporation, but it is attempt at democratic elections, the first representative assembly. They gathered July 30th, 1619. They canceled August 4th because it got too hot. And 13 days later, here comes the boat with the first Africans. And at that time, slavery was not racialized. You had white slaves and you had black slaves. But the white slaves, you look on the register of 1621, they had names like James Stewart and Charles McGregor. But you look on the right side and you see Negro, 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 Negro. So even before slavery became a perpetual and inheritable structure of domination that would exploit the labor of Africans and devalue their sense of who they were and view their bodies as an abomination, you already had the black problematic of namelessness. White supremacy was already setting in as another dominant ideology to ensure that these working people do not come together. And corporate greed would run amok in the midst of that kind of deep and profound division, which is not just a political division. It's a creation of different worlds, so that the de facto white supremacist segregation that would be part and parcel of the formation of the American empire would constitute very different worlds and constitute a major challenge to what it means to be a leftist in America from 1776 up until 1963, given the overthrow of American apartheid, which took place in the 60s. And then we now wrestle with the legacy, with the triumph of the black freedom movement and all of the white and brown and yellow and Asian comrades who were part and parcel of that black freedom movement that broke the back of American apartheid in the 60s. Now, what am I saying? I'm saying in part that at least for me, to be a leftist these days, in the way in which, and I take very seriously Antonio Gramsci's concern about the historical specificity of the emergence, sustenance, and development, and subsequent decline of the American empire. And when you actually look closely at that empire, it seems to me, what we have to come to terms with is the fundamental role of corporate greed, religious ideologies, white supremacy, the fundamental role of popular culture, youth, and acknowledging anytime you're talking about white supremacy, you're always already in some way talking about the treatment of black women. And if you're concerned about the treatment of black women, you ought to be concerned about the treatment of women across the board. So the vicious ideologies of patriarchy come in, and the same would be true for the James Baldwin and the Audre Lordes, the gay brothers and the lesbian sisters. You see? Now, where does that leave us? Well, for me, and you all know about the Covenant Movement, Tavis Smiley. The book that was launched last year went number one in the New York Times. We sold 400,000 copies within 9 months, not reviewed by the New York Times, not touched by the Today Show. Even Oprah wouldn't breathe on it. She can breathe on books and sell 500,000 these days, you know that. We just asked Sidney Poitier and Brother Elie Wiesel for that. But this book went underground. Why? Because Tavis Smiley knows that in an American culture that is so thoroughly commodified, driven by corporate greed, thoroughly commercialized, driven by corporate greed, thoroughly marketized, driven by corporate greed, you have to be able to communicate in such a way that you might be able then to shake people from their sleepwalking, which he's done every year now on C-SPAN, and uses his position in order to raise issues of right to health care, community-based policing, so you can deal with some of this police brutality, especially in black and brown communities of proletarian and lumpen proletarian character. And so you look in New York Times last Sunday, volume 2 is number 7. 150,000 copies sold in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. We just got off a 21-city tour. We did a 22-city tour last year. The book, not reviewed at all. Mainstream television won't touch it. What is going on? Is the ice age beginning to melt? Is it the case that the 35 years that Brother Stanley talked about the Ice Age, a historical period where it's fashionable to be indifferent to other people's suffering. Indifference is a very trait that makes the very angels weep. To be callous toward catastrophe. And it's true, New Orleans was catastrophic before Katrina hit. Flint, New Orleans without Katrina. We can look at places in Brooklyn, Harlem, South Side of Chicago, burials in East Los Angeles, white brothers and sisters in Kentucky, Appalachia, wrestling with catastrophic situations. You see, catastrophic situations, meaning what? Meaning that maybe we're at a moment now where there's going to be multiple strategies going on. It's clear that the Democratic Party remains clueless, visionless, and spineless for the most part. Does that mean you give up on them? No, it doesn't mean you give up on them, but you have to be honest with them. But it does allow one to, in some way, and this is what I think Brother Rick Wolf was talking about in terms of the disaggregation of the right-wing consensus. The unbelievable ways in which now right-wing fellow citizens are at each other's throats. The evangelical right-wing can't stand the free marketeers, can't stand the ballot budgeters. That's fine. Let them fight. Let them fight. Let them go at each other. They're weakened in that way. But what kind of alternative do we have? I don't have an answer to that. I don't think that the left has enough resources, has enough people to constitute a strong political organization, Stanley. We can argue over this. We just had drinks for 2 hours, so we've already had some discussion. I think that by raising the issue, it forces us to come to terms with who we really are. That's what I like. That's Socratic. That's provocative. Now, what we do with it, I don't know. I really don't. But the reason why I say that is because historically, for me, you know, most of the kind of leftist movements tended to actually respond to reformist activity in which the struggle against white supremacy was a major catalyst. And so when I think of all the work that I'm doing right now, especially in Black America, but always, of course, tied to an interesting coalition, leftist identity is not going to be the major means by which you get at people to wake up and come to terms with their social misery and be willing to stand up courageously, articulate vision, and most importantly, have a slice of people who are willing to live and die for a cause, you see, because they have other stories and other narratives that they use to do that. So I would even argue in some way that Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer were much more important than the Black Panther Party. They were actually building on what Martin and the others built, as much as I love Huey and Bobby Seale. They took it further, but the door was opened by these reformist activities. And what I would love to see is the radical reformism once more become fashionable among young people and then allow the leftists to come in and do our thing. That's what I'm looking for. I better stop now. Thank you very much.
Princeton University Professor Cornel West speaking at the Left Forum here in New York City. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a DVD copy or read the transcript, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Aaron Matei, Jen Yutz, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney. Happy birthday, Aaron Matei. Special thanks to Angela Alston, Susie Salami, and Andrew Quinn. Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. On Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock actually, I'll be at Judson Church here in New York with Italian journalist Giuliana Sgrena, who was abducted in Iraq for a month. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.